Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM Sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Imprint Companion. I am one half of your physical media fiends, Blake Howard, here spinning discs and talking the great Australian boutique Blu-ray label Imprint Films. Now, normally I've got Alexi Toliopoulos on the other line, but this time I've got a very special guest because we're talking an incredible new release coming from Imprint Film Focus, the films of Harvey Keitel between 1992 and 99. I have with me a terrific author, a great video essayist, a top shelf critic, and one of the most underrated deployers of the Australian accent, not to live in the Antipodes. He is my friend, Scout Tafoya. Hello, my friend. How are you?
Hello. How's it going? A pleasure. A fucking pleasure to be back, as always. Always happy to make it into the 1 minute world.
Well, we love to have you here. The Film Focus Harvey Keitel box set brings us together because the great folks at Imprint had a Film Focus Harvey Keitel box set, which features films such as Bad Lieutenant, Young Americans, Dangerous Game, Imaginary Crimes, Clockers, and then Holy Smoke, an absolutely murderer's row of Ferrara and Campion and Spike Lee. Just an incredible like buffet of some of the great films by the legendary Harvey Keitel, as well as a terrific 4K release of Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs, which we're also going to touch on. And as happens, the offer came through for me to be a part of such a set. And I was lucky enough to be asked, you know, who else do you know that would be appropriate for this? We have a couple of essay slots. Do you have anyone you can recommend? The first person I recommended was yourself because I'm like, I feel like I know Scout has so much to say about Harvey. I feel like I've seen so many of your terrific unloved essays and anything you've written. I feel like he's got some great Harvey stuff. So I went out to Scout and I said, can you write a piece on his career? Is there some way we can get you to do his career? I focused on Holy Smoke, Jane Campion's film, and I tried to bring the difference with mine is I really wanted to bring the Australian ennui that is represented in that film under the fucking microscope in a way. So you'll be reading a lot about that, but man alive, I read your beautiful work. The only feedback I had was, can it be its original 6,000 words? but I just want to say it was such a pleasure to collab with you. Sean Burns, of course, did Bad Lieutenant, which I think that's like, you know, peas and carrots. But I just want to say thank you so much for your contribution. It was so cool working with you again, and so cool that we're going to be in this little box together. It's going to be rad opening it up and seeing our names together. But man,
very
alive.
Much, very much.
What an unbelievable, brave fascination Harvey Keitel is. Like, what a guy. So let's start there and just go, man alive, how good is Harvey Keitel? He's now 85. His 85th year on this planet as we're talking, and looking back at this, you know, wildly different purple patch in his career, one of many. It was just such a treat to come back and to sort of dive in deep. So summarize for the folks who are obviously going to get their hands on your beautiful, beautiful essay about it. But like, summarize for the folk what makes Harvey one of your guys.
Oh wow! I mean, okay. So going way, way back, you know, there's I think a pretty typical way that a lot of people get into movies is you're watching them over the shoulders of other people, and in my instance, it was my dad. And as I was getting older, I kept hearing about Bad Lieutenant because there was this like legendary story that he and my mom and some of their friends watched it and everybody was completely horrified. And my dad was just like, he loved it. It was so nuts. And so we had the VHS, which still had, I wanted to signify an MC on it. Like it still had the music that was cut out of it. So it was just, you know, it was unlike anything I'd seen up to that point. Like I'd seen like a couple of gross New York movies and certainly I'd seen newer New York movies and the, you know, the kind of like fairy tale Royal Tenenbaums version of it, the Joe versus the Volcano New York. But I'd never seen anything like this. And I'm thinking, this is so unlike any other fucking movie. The scene with him dancing, the scene obviously with him pulling the girls over, like I just it's mesmerizing, and it all rests on him. Obviously Ferrara has a terrific sense of place that can also be used in movies like Dangerous Game or New Rose Hotel or Siberia in a negative capacity as well, where you feel like you're nowhere. Yes. And he can do both of those things really, really well. And so I'm watching this thing set in a New York that seems like Hieronymus Bosch. And through it all is this just this demonic presence in the center of it. And he just keeps losing his mind further. And like, and I, you know, the fucking sounds he's making in that film. And you're thinking, okay, so yes, that is as good as he got because it's as good as performances on film get.
Yes.
But, you know, that was really the only showcase. And so really what you then look for throughout all the rest of his career is just more of that, more of the shades and more of the intensity. And you just want to spend time watching this guy completely, you know, spew up these things inside of himself. And he's one of the very few actors where it's like, okay, you know that he can do this. You know that he is capable of completely destroying the self on film and removing the ego and being literally and figuratively naked in front of you and having these horrifying moments of you know, I mean, literally attempting to become Christ-like, which is a theme of his, which is fascinating because, again, he was born to Jewish parents. So he became this very, very particular arbiter of, you know, the Catholic morality of a lot of his directors, you know, people like Ferrara and Scorsese, and maybe, I mean, Lena Wertmuller, but not, he wasn't really like a Wertmuller player. He was just sort of a cameo.
The best possible utility for a Lena Wertmuller. Like, just come
very
in.
Very much.
I need you for this. Much like Tarantino. Yeah. Tarantino deploys him in the same way. I need a utility, reliable, you know, has these elements. And like, you think about it, like Bad Lieutenant and Reservoir Dogs come out in the same year and you're like, holy shit, like this is two totally wildly different flexes of a muscle.
And you expected him to have, you know, like, holy smoke. And I am so anxious to read the like pure Oz point of view on that, because that's a movie that really does capture the wooziness of Jane Campion's point of view. And the idea that, again, she reaches for this macho American, whatever, this guy who's supposed to come in and literally introduces him like he is Jesus, like coming into the airport with sunglasses and the Neil Diamond, and he's passing out like these, you know, God, it's amazing. Like, you know, and yet he became a supporting player almost the day after. Like, yeah, you know, it was like I expected him to just continue to get the kinds of roles that he's really good at. But I think a desire to work, because, you know, it's about making productions with and for friends of yours to raise money for that. And also, of course, he had three children and, you know, but I was kind of bummed that as good as he is in the side parts, that he never continued, like that he didn't get to keep being a leading man in the way that De Niro and Pacino did, because he's just astonishing. And you can't take your eyes off of him. He's got one of the most particular kind of like puggish faces. He's got like a 30s face.
Yes.
And he's just always incredibly honest and raw in a way that is scary and exciting. And, you know, he's one of those people that, like, Reservoir Dogs is a great, you know, window into that, because you do kind of believe, even more so than Madsen, yeah, this guy would fucking kill you if you got in it, you know, if you got in his way. And he's, you know, you're between him and what he wants. Yeah, he would fucking kill you. Like, that is the energy that that guy gives off. And, you know,
the mirror scene in Reservoir Dogs, so especially in the 4K, it's one of my favorite scenes in my recollections, as we have movies, but they never quite play out exactly in crisp 4K detail, especially if you're not, like, if you haven't seen right. one of your favorite movies for a ton of time. There's a scene where he's talking to Buscemi about, like, the betrayal, and, you know, they're sort of figuring out that, you know, that there is a rat in their crew. How were the police there? Those sorts of things. And there's this moment where he's just staring down the barrel of the, like, it's the camera is positioned so perfectly so that you can actually see him staring and fighting and arguing and having a conversation that is vastly more about an interior monologue rather than a conversation with Buscemi. And the way yep. that he is staring at himself, like the ferocity and intensity that Tarantino is like fixated on, I'm just like, this is like Harvey Keitel porn. Like, it's just,
yeah.
he is like, if you were between him and the mirror, you would fade into nothingness. Like, it's just the yes. intensity is so yep. crazy. And so that, like, and that starts, like, it starts so far back. Like, it starts, you know, obviously he's got things like Mean Streets and like those things which sort of typify his career. But I know, because you have such an affinity for the Scott brothers, as do I, like the mm-hmm. Duelist as Gabriel Ferrar, like, he makes no, there's no sense to, like, why he's that guy. And I think you touched on it beautifully in your essay. There's no sense as to why, but it's then when you go, who cares about his nationality? Look at the obsession that this guy can render on screen. Doesn't matter where he's from. I don't think that anyone else can be, is up to that. Like, they're not up to that. In
yeah.
Anything.
And it's also, you know, I hadn't really paid very careful attention to a lot of the films on the set before, where really sitting down with Imaginary Crimes, for instance, yeah. that's a fascinating thing, because he's so nice in that you hate to see him fall into the traps that he has sprung for himself as a dishonest person with very specific plans that he knows are doomed to fail.
Yes.
And, you know, I think anyone else could have really played up his likability or really played up his underhandedness. It's this very fascinating middle ground that he strikes for himself, where you just kind of buy that he's a guy. He's not some crazy out of control dreamer, you know, he's not the most cuddly person in the world, which I think would absolutely have been what that would have been like in that period. You know,
yes.
everybody wasn't Rock Hudson and all that heaven allows back then. They were just guys. And it works as both a series of choices that he's making, but also physically what he is bringing to every part. He's got the everyman look, no matter how beautiful it is. He's not, you know, he doesn't have the Alain Delon face. You're not like, oh, that's a, you know, that's a movie actor or whatever, or a movie star. It's just like, no, that's a fascinating guy. And I loved seeing the way that he knows how to deploy his, you know, his physiognomy is like, he, you know, it's Saturn III. Like,
yeah.
He's speaking in someone else's voice, and it is a completely insane departure for him, even before you factor in the dubbing. And yet it's like, you cannot take your eyes off of this fucking guy. You know, he's like got the like space Nazi look. And there's just such intensity that you're like, yeah, I wouldn't trust this fucking guy for 10 seconds. And so like, this is insane.
It's that that's my thing about Holy Smoke. You know, Australia's had this, you know, there's like a cultural imperialism that we suffer because our, you know, with prior to the beautiful genre that is Ozploitation, like it was a, there was a cultural void. And so this idea that like Americana, and particularly like Harvey Keitel, someone like that is so alluring and enrapturing and a subject of fascination right from the outset. Like it works so beautifully paired then. When he faces off with, I mean, you maybe only have one superior in the Australian accent game, and that's Kate Winslet. Like, because she is so fucking amazing at the Australian accent that you're just like, of course, Jane Campion like clocked that. Yes, look, she's the girl from Titanic, but this is one of our next huge generational talents. So let's throw her into the cauldron of being one-to-one with Harvey Keitel. And let's just see where this goes. And of course, it's absolutely outstanding.
It's completely mesmerizing where, you know, like most Campion, it really doesn't behave the way you expect it to, given the premise, given everything else. You really, I mean, you know, there's that movie starts and already the premise doesn't come off the way that you expect it to, because the way that they're presenting Winslet in India is it's just like a vacation. Like there's no sense of danger. There's no nothing. It's just like she's just out there having fun. And then you cut back to her parents and they're terrified and they're like, you know, they're just like beside themselves. They don't know how to act anymore. And it's like this kind of hysteria has already started, that the movie has begun at 10 and cannot diffuse itself. And every person makes the situation crazier and everything makes it worse. And then you expect Keitel, based on his intro, to sort of bring this calming, you know, force to everything. And then he gets sucked into the madness as well, because he's got all of the usual problems of a Campion male protagonist.
Yeah.
He is all insecurity wrapped up in everything. And you kind of expect it to take on more of like a Pinter-esque, you know, combative structure. But it really isn't like that. It's so much stranger. And all of the very peculiar ways in which these two sort of try to suss each other out and fix each other becomes like, you know, so desperate and so strange. And of course, because it's Australian, in the end, he's wearing a dress because that simply must happen to the emasculated Australian man. It's just, there's no way around it.
it's that the ending is all time.
No,
it's the ending is all time in the back of the ute in a red dress streaming through the desert with Dion Beebe's gorgeous cinematography. You're like, yeah, this, there was only one outcome.
That's right.
It was only one outcome. I didn't realize that this was the one, but now that it's there, it's like, yeah, this is the one outcome.
This is the only way this could have ended. Absolutely.
I think you know, he worked with Tarantino a couple of times. Obviously he'd worked with Campion a couple of times. And I just always think of, you know, that absolutely essential and hilarious scene where Samuel Jackson's Jules is freaking out about like what is going to happen. John Travolta has just accidentally created a Jackson Pollock in the back of a car. And he's like, I'm panicking. That's right. You know, he's freaking out on the phone. He ain't got no problem, Jules. I'm on the motherfucker. You know, I'm sending in the wolf.
Yeah.
And it feels like Tarantino, because obviously he is such an aficionado for time periods and like actors and their history and their lore and being able to wield that at his, you know, at his beck and call almost. But I feel like that scene is so perfect because like I'm sending in the wolf. Like it feels like every Harvey Keitel movie is I'm sending in the wolf. And they, oh, that's all you had to say. That's all you had to say. It's a Harvey Keitel. That's all you had to say. Feels like a catch-all or a catch cry for every single Harvey Keitel movie. Oh, Harvey Keitel. That's all you had to say, man. That's all you had to say. We're in good hands.
Yeah, it's, you know, even in parts where it doesn't really make any sense that they went for him, but they did for international financing or whatever you want to say. You know you're in good hands, that this guy isn't going to, he's not going to overact. He's not going to, you know, like be indulgent, because he was never that kind of an actor. You know, you go back to the early performances or whatever, and it's like Mean Streets again, this time focusing on him specifically, was such a revelation, because everybody else in the movie is kind of going for it a little more, And he's the one who comes off reserved and you know, as level-headed as those guys get. And I was just so mesmerized, you know, when you think to look at it. And you know, Mean Streets, like a lot of Scorsese, you know, you're not thinking about the performances, you're thinking about the flow. You're thinking about, yeah, like, you know, the amazing montage, the Thelma Schoonmaker, you know, the rhythm and the songs and the violence. And it's all this great, big, you know, whirling dervish of violent, exciting, romantic energy. And so when you really focus in on what people are bringing to these things, you can still be surprised by them, even if you've seen them 100 times. And he is so sensitive and interesting, and you know, you can, it just in the way he carries himself, and then again in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, where he goes from being this really lovely breath of fresh air to being somebody that you would have to call the police, like it's incredible. And you know, and at no point does it feel like a stretch, because he never puts himself in situations where he's going to be let down by the decisions that he's making. He doesn't do things that he knows he can't, you know, kind of use or diffuse later. You know, even just the idea of casting him as Judas is like the most insane thing you've ever heard in your life. If on paper somebody comes to you and they say, yeah, they made a movie about Jesus in the 80s and Harvey Keitel is second billed, like, what the fuck are you talking about? Fucking Brooklyn Harvey. Yeah. And yeah,
in so just before the Keitel set is released, so at the time people are listening, Imprint also brings out a Martin Scorsese box set called Martin Scorsese Films of Faith 1988 to 2016, which features Kundun, Silence, and The Last Temptation of Christ. And it's just like, yeah, of course, in this movie that is, that's just such a great choice of like, every actor feels real. I think the one thing that Harvey Keitel has, which you talked about, is sort of puggish face, this like great face that he has and it's so good, is they don't make them like Harvey Keitel. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes when you cast him against like these more, I don't know, like typically beautiful kind of actor presences, there's an immediate friction, because it's like, I believe everything that Harvey Keitel is doing. And sometimes that, in some ways, depending on who you deploy him with, they can't hold the screen with him because they don't know what to do. It's like you kind of need to come, there needs to be some kind of surrender and this ability to come to his level. And I think Campion talks about like, when he feels loved and trusted, he will go anywhere. He's braver than any actor that she had at that point in her career worked with. She's like, there is no one that is like him on the planet that I can put into a scene and that can deliver for me like him. It's that, you know, that utility thing. It's not even utility. He's a specialist, but he can be used as a utility because he can do anything. But it's like, there is something that the other actors have to come to his level to meet him. And if you're not there, there is a yawning chasm between Harvey and you. And so it's like, he's just one of those guys. He's just one of those guys.
He really is. And I, you know, in, Lansky, which is the third of his, you know, organized crime trilogy of performances.
Yeah.
He makes other good actors look worse by virtue of just being himself. Like John Majaro, who I love and I think has been absolutely stupendous, can only seem feeble when playing young Harvey Keitel.
Yeah.
Because I know what young Harvey Keitel looked and acted like, and it's just like, yeah, no, I'm sorry, you're doing an impression and you're not present the way that he would have been present in this scene. And it's like, again, it really does take somebody that good to make other people look feeble. And he is absolutely that person. But the thing is, if he had been in scenes with them and, like, you know, Sam Worthington, who, you know, whatever, fine, you know, you can see him really trying to pull himself up to meet Harvey Keitel on his level, where, you know, he go, like, when it scenes with him on the phone or whatever, it's, you know, it's the usual Sam Worthington performance. But then he's opposite Harvey Keitel in a diner, and you can just see in his head, he's like, fuck, this is like heat, and I'm not ready. I need to really give myself over to this thing, and does manage better work in that regard. But it's, you know, the other thing too is, as you were saying in Pulp Fiction, when that guy shows up, you know, he's at, you know, like, you're in great hands. But it's just true that whenever he shows up anywhere, you have an immediate sense of who this person is.
Yes.
The character choices, the costume choices, the posture. He shows up in the tuxedo, seen at a nice, you know, suburban LA party or whatever. And you're like, who is this guy? Like, why is he hobnobbing with movie producers or whatever and then coming to clean up murders? And it's just like, yeah, he's like, yeah, no, I believe this character. I fully believe the psychology of this guy, you know, and it works in Young Americans, which, you know, has a lot of, you know, there, it's cop movie levels of believability, and you just kind of have to go with it. But he helps you. He steadies you in that way. There was no, you know, even like the first scene in Blue in the Face where he catches somebody stealing near Sorvino's purse and then lets the kid go because he's so mad at the end of the conversation with Mira Sorvino that he needs to now punish her. It's nonsense. It's complete like improv game nonsense. But it's like, yeah, it works. And you buy that this guy did it because this is the energy that he has given off. And the second he walked on screen, you absolutely believe that that is that guy. And there is, you know, again, it's just he comes on, he has his goals, and he has, you know, his character built into the way that he's carrying himself and the way that he's dressed and the way that he has his hair and every other thing. And he just is so specific, and he does his thing exactly as you said. He's like the cleaner of movies, you know. He's you send in the wolf and your movie is going to be fine.
Yeah, and it's also the only guy, and because obviously it's one Heat Minute Productions, I have to mention this, he's the only guy in the absolutely ghastly Red Dragon from Brett Ratner that walk into Michael Mann's Manhunter and be fine.
Absolutely true.
Because you see the polish, the gloss, the nonsense of like blonde-haired Edward Norton and Anthony Hopkins, not quite digitally de-aged, but like they're trying to de-age him and they're trying to like make people look a certain way. And he just walks in and he's delivering a role and a role previously done by Farina. And he's so excellent, but it's like, he just looks like a guy who has got mileage. His mileage is such a currency that other people just don't have it. Like when it's, it's the same reason where they're like, yeah, let's cast an Australian. Cause maybe they didn't grow up in the LA area to be X person. They're just some, you know, there's some guy they grew up there, maybe worked on a building site, they played rugby league, they had pub fights growing up, they've got a bit of a bent nose, you know, there's just something. It's like when Harvey gets on, you're like, oh, I'm just going to stare at his face, the power of his face. There's, I'm going to dwell in it. It's lovely. It's like,
yeah.
And yeah. Also big shout out, cause I know you'll appreciate this. There are some actual freaks on the film internet subculture that have actually plotted out a tour of where Harvey Keitel's member was exposed in New Zealand, if you're a fan of The Piano. So,
of course.
To those New Zealand film freaks, you're really doing the right work. I just want to say,
that's what the internet is for, by the way. That's why they made it.
This is exactly why they made it. I want to know that these people exist. I'm so happy that they do. But man, look, honestly, such a treat. Always love collabing. And this has been so cool because it's more of a formal collab than we've done before. Such a treat to write about. And again, for me, I'm a big fan of Campion, obviously, because she's, you know, she straddles the sort of, as a Kiwi, she sort of straddles that weird, you know, line of like Oz Kiwi because of, you know, there's all these weird hierarchical things that happen. Sometimes like you're a New Zealand director, you come to Australia, you do a slightly bigger film, you go to America, et cetera. There's this weird sort of like shared, outcomes that happen. You know, Russell Crowe comes to Oz first, works in Oz, then moves to the States, all those things, then moves to Italy to just make nothing but Pope's Exorcist movies, which I'm so here for.
Absolutely.
She's such a treasure. But I think a lot of people at the time when they were reading that film, which I'm excited to share with my essay, is I think a lot of people at that time didn't realize she wasn't just doing that kind of British sort of eccentricity thing in the Australian landscape and in the Australian character at the time. She was talking about this inherent xenophobia of this burgeoning sort of culture of Australia that was about to explode at the time. And Sydney was going to go from like a big country town essentially to an international city. And there's that fear of like, what is our culture? But the culture is also empty. It's just this white consumerist, you know, toe the line culture. And her family and all these weird characters in it, like they are patently ridiculous, but that doesn't make them any less authentic, which I think is also so special. And then you throw Harvey Keitel in there as this outsider in this thing. And I love what you said, which is that as soon as he gets in, he gets like caught in a maelstrom of madness and he can't, there's no way that he's not going anything but down the drain with every single other person in the movie. So, man, it's a treat to talk to you. You are such a freaking genius. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat to me and be a part of this, because I knew, you know, you understood the assignment. So thank you so much for writing so beautifully about him. I can't wait for people to I'm spoiled because I've read it. I can't wait for other people to read it. So but yeah, thank you, man, for doing this. And thanks for talking to me about Harvey. And for everyone who's listening, you not only have a great Film Focus box set, you not only have the Scorsese box set, you not only have you not only have the incredible 4K, I'm sure there are 4K versions of Reservoir Dogs out there in the world, but if you haven't seen that yet, definitely go and check that out, because there is one at Via Vision. It's really incredible. And yeah, I just really want to say, like, thank you guys, take the time, seek it out. And also there is a Smoke special edition that is coming out as well with Keitel. So another separate Smoke and Blue in the Face double set, which is also coming out. So if you need to really up your Harvey Keitel physical media game on imprint,
never been a better time.
And Via Vision, you've got, you know, there's plenty of time for you to pre-order and make that happen. But thank you so much, man, for taking the time to talk to me about it.
Yeah, it's such a privilege. Thank you so much. And everybody enjoy. You've got a bounty on your hands.
Oh, I can't wait. Just the Ferraris.
That's the Ferraris.
It's just so amazing. Can't wait. Looking back on a track, gonna do it my way.
I can't do the noise right.
Oh yes, that noise, that signal is a better clarion call of the podcast than I could have possibly hoped for. Folks, we're back on this bumper, essentially pod focus of Harvey Keitel, because the beautiful people at Imprint Films have got Smoke, Blue in the Face, and a Harvey Keitel Film Focus collection, grabbing a whole bunch of movies between 1992 and 1999, including Bad Lieutenant, Clockers, Holy Smoke. What else have we got in there? I'm just looking at this set. It's unbelievable. Abel Ferrara's Dangerous Game. We've got Imaginary Crimes. It is a sensation. And Young Americans. And also from Imprint's bigger parent company, Via Vision Entertainment, we have the 4K of Reservoir Dogs. And so I'm joined by my now formerly co-published in the same little mini magazine and dear friend, my favorite Bostonian film critic, one of my favorite film critics in the world, Sean Burns, who joined me writing about Abel Ferrara's Bad Lieutenant for this incredible Harvey box set. Hello, my friend. It's great to see you again. I didn't need another excuse to talk to you, but it's so good to talk to you. We're here to talk about Harvey Keitel in the 90s specifically because, holy shit, like a box set that has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 movies could totally have been another 4. You know, it pretty much could have been any other
thing. Look, if you like to see Harvey Keitel dropping off felons at a bus or train station and yelling at them, this is your time.
It's your time. Or just rolling up
just
in a car.
Just do a double feature of Harvey at the bus station going, get the fuck out of this city.
Oh, man, alive. Tell me about Harvey, because you're a formally trained film critic, which is so rare to say. That should be a badge of honor, but it's like so weird right now. I mean, Lights, Camera, Jackson is the dominant film critic in our culture, so I'm not sure how much currency that has. But you're a formally trained critic. You have definitely got a great – he's one of your guys. You know, these new Hollywood guys are all your guys. We've talked about it a few times before in times that we've chatted. But tell me about Harvey specifically and why he's kind of the guy – who's both in the culture at the coalface of it, but also just beautifully on the outside, always sort of like one step off the kind of De Niro, Pacino orbit. And and how fascinating his career is, because that's for me what I love is like his resume always is just the most beautiful and insane selection of choices that don't have any rhyme or reason other than his passion, his bravery, like, and literally and figuratively being naked.
Well, I mean, that was the thing, right? He didn't get famous in the 70s and they all became huge stars and sort of left him behind, which, you know, he kind of bummed around Europe and had a strange career there. And then in the 90s, yeah, that left him in the perfect spot for, you know, De Niro never would have been in Reservoir Dogs.
No.
De Niro wouldn't have been in Abel Ferrara movies. These guys were too big, but there was Harvey.
Yes. And he comes back and he's because even your a fellow Bostonian of yours, Matt Damon, he and Ben Affleck, after writing Good Will Hunting, were calling the Robin Williams part, that's the Harvey Keitel part. Like it had become so synonymous with him as like, oh, you got to get the Harvey part. Cause if you nail the Harvey part, then we can make this independent film and make it successful. Cause people will at least trust that if a Harvey Keitel graces us with his presence, then we're on the right track. You know, we're doing something that's interesting and that people should see.
Well, yeah, he became this godfather figure to young independent filmmakers. I mean, after he basically made Reservoir Dogs, you know,
yeah.
Quentin was going to shoot that himself for $500,000 with his friends, and we never would have been talking about Quentin Tarantino probably.
No.
But Harvey got extra financing. He brought him to New York to meet all the New York actors. When I saw Quentin was at Sundance for the 20th anniversary.
Yeah.
The 25th, I guess. Yeah. I'm old, fuck. And he was telling the story about how Harvey flew him and Lawrence Bender to New York on his dime. And Harvey got a first-class ticket, and the boys were in coach. And he was talking to him at the little way station where the curtains are, and Harvey said to Quentin, you know, well, in a perfect world, there'd be no first class, and we'd all be on the plane together. But since there is, and shut the curtain. See you in New York.
Well, he went and had a lovely sleep and stretched out. He wasn't in the steerage, which is
I always thought it was touching that he plays the guy in Pulp Fiction who comes in and fixes everything.
That's, I mean, honestly, to give people a primer, if you haven't got the box set or you haven't thought about picking it up yet, it's going to be a really hot property, so you're going to have to be quick. But that's exactly how I think of him. He's defined by, you know, Tarantino has this beautiful thing of like finding the quintessence in certain actors when he casts them, especially those older guys. Like he just kind of gets what they're about. And I think of him like that. It's like, if you need, you know, it's that great Marcellus Wallace and Jules scene where he's like, you ain't got no problem, Jules. I'm on the motherfucker. Like, you know, I'm sending in the wolf. And he's like, the wolf? It's like, yeah, you got a problem? It's like, nah, man, that's all you had to say. It's like, yeah, so that's all you had to say. It's like Harvey Keitel's in this. Yes, that's all you had to say.
Yeah, I mean, even at the beginning of the 90s when he first kind of came back to Hollywood and you'd see these bad movies like The Two Jakes or
yeah.
Bugsy, like these really big budget bad movies. And there's Harvey Keitel being great in them. Like
yes,
he's the best part of The Two Jakes. He's the best part of Bugsy. And, you know, I was like, oh, this guy, where has he been, you know?
Yeah.
Besides in James Toback movies.
And- yeah. Being overdubbed. Even though he's overdubbed, he's somehow miraculously great. Like, it's just good. It's just really good. So talk to me. You wrote in this set. I did a big piece on Holy Smoke because I really wanted to talk about Harvey in contrast to the kind of Australian culture that's depicted because he's the coolest motherfucker in the world at the beginning of the movie. And there's a whole bunch of like what you would normally consider. Some people sort of easily dismiss it as like this very kind of British eccentricity based thing where everyone's kind of a bit weird and strange. But I think that's kind of campy and skewering at Australian xenophobia, which was my angle on it. But I asked you to write about Bad Lieutenant, which is one of the greatest, grubbiest movies of all time. So I'd love you to tell me a little bit about like Harvey and Bad Lieutenant, what that movie means to you. And I know that you've got such a great relationship in Boston with like the Brattle and stuff like that. So there are often rep screenings. I'm sure I've seen on your socials that you've seen Bad Lieutenant on the big screen at some point recently. But tell me about.
Oh, like, I saw it opening day.
Well, that too. You saw it. Tell me.
I just turned 18, so they carded me, and I could hold up my license and be like, "Hell yeah!"
So where did you see it?
18 on January 4th, and the movie opened on Valentine's Day weekend.
Oh. What a perfect Valentine's Day date movie. This, the Fall Guy, it's got it all.
Yeah, I mean, there were significantly fewer people in the movie theater when it was over than there were when it started. By then, I'd had a rule that I would just go see anything that Harvey Keitel was in.
That was how
I saw Reservoir Dogs. It was just like, oh, Harvey Keitel's the star? Cool, I'm going there.
Yeah.
And, on Fridays after in high school, I would just ditch after lunch, after like 12 o'clock, I would go and jump on the train and head into town and go to the art theaters because none of my friends wanted to see these weirdo movies with me. And so then I'd be home in time to go to the parties and stuff on Friday night and like not shut up about Reservoir Dogs or whatever I'd seen that day. But yeah, none of the boys were coming to see Howard's End with me.
It's a shame. I like that you went though.
But Harvey was sort of he was just like that. Oh, this guy's in it. We're there.
Yes.
And Bad Lieutenant had been hearing about for months. I mean, he was all over. He was promoting it everywhere. And it was so controversial. And, you know, I mean, I think it had been kicking around since the previous Cannes or something. I mean, you couldn't escape hearing about this film. It's like, well, you know, it's NC-17. Will it come to Boston? Won't it come to Boston? And it had gone through on everybody's 10 best list. And I was, you know. I was much more patient than I guess you had to be, just waiting for movies to come around. Now you lose your mind if you have to wait.
Yeah. Even we're seeing it right now with a certain Mad Max film. People are freaking out. It's just some of my dear friends are writing on Twitter, if you've seen Furiosa, I hate you. I'm like, okay, cool.
I was saying to someone the other day, it's like, I know some Aussie prick has seen it already, but we haven't.
Well, listen. What I would say is, just speaking for a Mad Max film, it should fucking premiere here. And if it premiered anywhere, it should make me like travel 6 hours west of Sydney to go to Broken Hill where they film this fucking thing and like make me go see it there. Like it should make me go to the wasteland to go see like the seminal franchise of my country. So, you know, I suppose
you guys can have this one. If you'd gotten Bad Lieutenant first, that would have been weird.
Yeah. It would make no sense.
But yeah, you want to talk about the most, I mean, it's like the most fearless performance ever, and not just because he shows his dick. I mean, he does that all the time.
Yeah, he's fine with, there's apparently a walking tour in New Zealand where you can go to all the locations where he unsheathed in the piano, thanks to the internet. So, you know, one of my favorite facts on researching Harvey Keitel, I was like, bless you, New Zealand film geeks, you're doing the good work. But no, I that fearlessness for me, even... I know that like Reservoir Dogs is very flashy and, you know, pulpy, no pun intended, but I was watching the 4K the other day and I'm looking forward to seeing a couple of these other flicks that, you know, we write about and we share the box set with in our collaboration. But man, there's that scene in Reservoir Dogs where he's talking to Buscemi's Miss Pink character and he's combing his hair in the mirror. Mm-hmm. And it's a scene where it's like Harvey versus Harvey. It's like his external thoughts versus his inner monologue. And the ferocity that he like brings to his scrutiny of himself, even in a mirror, you're like, who can do that? Like, there's not many actors that could just comb their hair and have self-loathing like Superman lasers, like smashing out of his eyes and reflecting back to himself. Like him. And that's just like a fleeting moment of that. I'm like, he has his upside, or he's like his ability to hit crescendos in performances, especially when he strings it all together in something like so great, like Bad Lieutenant, is almost like unparalleled. Like there aren't actors who can just keep his frequency that whole time.
I love that part in Reservoir Dogs because there's few actors so good at not quite getting something.
Yes. Yes.
And Buscemi's getting so pissed that he has to explain this.
He's like talking through every step.
And Keitel's like, what? Oh. But yeah, I mean, he's got that great fun. I mean, in Bad Lieutenant, it's, for all of its horrors, is actually really fucking funny.
Like, very funny.
Starting the film with him just screaming at his dumb children for being late for school because Aunt Judy was in the bathroom. You know, I mean, everything with the family is just excruciatingly funny. And the way they don't talk to him, just walk around him. Like, he's just this ogre on the couch.
So funny.
Well, yeah, I mean, the fearlessness, I mean, jerking off on the girls he pulls over. I mean, God, I think that's when the theater emptied out when I saw it. Because to not just do this scene, but, like, the humiliation of that scene when it's over.
Yes.
Like, it's... it's more, it becomes more of a scene about his embarrassment than the horrific violation itself. Like, the girls are just sitting there when he's done, like, can we go now?
And it's the same thing with, like, in Holy Smoke, you know, my personal philosophy is you only know how good an actor is when you put them against another actor who is amazing and they hold their own. And that's where you, like, if you didn't already, if you weren't quite satisfied that Kate Winslet had acted, like, showed her true acting chops in something like Titanic, you're like, oh, she's great, but, you know, this is a Jim Cameron spectacle. Maybe she's just a flash in the pan. Maybe we'll never see her again. But you see her in Holy Smoke, you're like, oh, no, she's got it up to 100. And that scene of, like, her soiling herself, walking through the desert, hypnotizing him, and then you think they're going to go have this passionate love scene, and immediately Campion is just like, takes them into the bedroom, and it's Winslet going, don't come. And Harvey goes, oh, he just comes immediately. And you're like, what a fucking ballsy performer, man. Because immediately after that, you're like, oh no, this is, we are not watching the fixer come in and fix this problem. We're watching something completely different. And it's just that note. And also, like you said, in movies that can be really serious, have super serious content, like, that's a laugh out loud moment for me. Like, I howl at that moment. It's so funny. And he's just so great at that bit.
He's got such a wonderful entrance in that film. Like,
oh, the best. Just
a slow-mo the and the Neil Diamond.
The boots, the mustache. He looks like, you know, I think some of the great reviews of that are like him walking off like he's entering a prize fight. You know, he comes in, he's got the boots, it's like WWE wrestling. And he should just come in and swamp Kate Winslet's character, but he doesn't. She swallows him up.
Oh, I know. And to let himself be depicted in that way, you know, you wouldn't see De Niro doing that.
No,
I mean,
no one wants. It's the great scene from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. You know, you don't get beaten up. You don't do these things. You don't embarrass yourself. Right. Harvey Keitel's like, that's all I want to do. I don't want to be the guy that, you know, I want to be the guy that skewers at every point, can skewer the perception. And that's my favorite thing to do as an actor. That's the coolest shit.
Yeah, I mean, he's good. I mean, what do you think of Dangerous Game? That's always been one I've enjoyed. That
I haven't seen Dangerous Game in ages. And the reason that I haven't is because the last time I literally could see it in Australia, I saw it on a VHS tape in a university library. I have not seen Dangerous Game. I have not seen Dangerous Game in a long time. It was me on a tangent going down people like Ferrara and Michael Mann and those people who orbited the big new Hollywood stuff but were happening adjacent. So I'm looking forward to that because I'm like, oh man, like Madonna, Harvey Keitel. I'm like, I'm into this. Like I can't place it. But was that a big one for you, Ferrara's Dangerous Game?
It was a really funny experience. I think it's a really good movie. I don't think it's great. I think it was sort of set up. People were expecting something that it wasn't because it's just a strange, it's a very strange film. But I went to see it. It was at this twin screen theater in the old Art Greenwich Twin, deep in Greenwich Village, in the West Village. So it was me and like a whole crowd of gay guys who were there to see Madonna the first show opening day, who were not expecting an Abel Ferrara movie that would end with Harvey Keitel rolling on the floor in a puddle of his own vomit. That was not the movie they came to see.
And instead, they're all horrified and mortified, and you're on your feet applauding in the theater.
I'm like, this is what I came for. What are you talking about? He sings Harry Chapin's Taxi to Madonna, and then that's when she decides to sleep with him. Like, how else can So yeah, that's yeah. I'm very excited that's in the set because I'd like to watch that again.
But Clockers too, like such a, a terrific, terrific movie. I haven't seen it in a long time. And
oh yeah, I saw it again recently when the, that was funny though. Cause I remember when that one came out, I had read the book first and I was like, this has gotta be Harvey Keitel. And then Scorsese was supposed to direct the movie and De Niro was going to play Rocco. And then Scorsese dropped out and De Niro dropped out, and then the part went to Harvey, and I was like, well, that's how it's always shifted.
Like, someone was in my inner casting monologue when I was reading that, of course.
Well, yeah, there was that. I remember vividly the description. I read that book a couple of times. It's one of Richard Price's A God, but Price describes Rocco as having a smile like he's heard the joke you're telling anyways, and is patiently, he's heard it before, and he's patiently waiting to let you finish it. It's like I could see Harvey making that face in my head so vividly.
That sort of smug, I'm already five steps ahead of you. Like, he's got that in spades.
He's just kind of letting you go with it, and then he's going to start.
I completely forgot. But also, there's a Films of Faith Martin Scorsese box set, which also comes out, which has Harvey as Judas in
maybe the greatest performance ever.
Which is just also like, again, the riches of Harvey Keitel, but like, it's so great, that connection right from the beginning of Mean Streets all the way to Last Temptation, of watching his avatar for Faith. And it's like, it's such a funny movie. It's like, oh, where does Scorsese situating his perspective here? Who does he actually relate to in this movie? And I think casting Harvey in that is so beautiful and sensational because he does, I mean, forget accents, forget this. It's just like, what essence do you need? And Keitel is just like, he's always going to be that New York guy, but like, that's the kind of madness and excess of that movie is just,
well, it's like the brilliance of that film, because they're all New York guys. It's like Victor Argo and Harvey and John Lurie, and because why wouldn't, the apostles are working class guys. It's crazy. When that movie came out, it got the dumbest reviews. Like, I remember like Peter Travers, whenever he would mention Harvey Keitel, being, you know, Brooklyn Judas.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's, I was clearly a choice. That's why all the Romans are British, smart guy.
Yes. Yes.
And we show my friend who teaches film at the technical high school here. We every year we do a Scorsese class with the juniors. And we did it again this week, and we show the last scene, the end of Last Temptation, like the last 10 minutes when Judas comes back and when the revelation. We spoil the ending for them all. But every class we talk about, you know, why when the apostles talk that way, did it, none of the kids today have a problem with it.
Yeah.
Like, well, yeah, I mean, they sound like fishermen.
Yes. Yes. They sound like someone who works in a factory, and that's good. That's what I want. I want working class.
Harvey also has one of the funniest lines in that movie when he's like, this turn the other cheek thing. I don't like that.
that should be his memoir. Should be the title. I don't like that. It's turn the other cheek thing. Because he is a guy.
What an interesting career, just looking at all these movies and realizing they all came in such a short, compressed bump like that. That's just,
it is crazy, because you look at, like, you look later, he's working steadily. Like, he's in a ton of things, a ton of TV. He pops up in a lot of little things, you know, a lot of silly things like Little Nicky or whatever. But like, that 90s period where you go, I mean, this is...
And at the same time, he was in, like, Sister Act.
Exactly. That's what I was just about to say. It's like you go from 89... So you just go to 90. You've got, like, two Jakes, Thelma and Louise, Reservoir Dogs, Bad Lieutenant, Sister Act, The Piano, Dangerous Game, Young Americans, Pulp, Imaginary Crime, Smoke, Blue in the Face, Clockers, Get Shorty, From Dusk Till Dawn, Copland. Like,
you know, Get Shorty is one line and it brought the house down.
Yeah. Like, totally. Like, and then Holy Smoke is 99. He's in like U571. And then it all like flips a little bit. He's into the early 2000s and people kind of don't really know what the hell to do with him. He's in like National Treasure. He moves on to that, some of those other things. He's in TV series Life on Mars. He pops back.
Well, they stopped making Harvey Keitel movies.
They stopped making them. That's exactly what it is. It's like that whole thing where we're like, oh, that mid-budget 90s, blah, 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 interesting, evocative kind of like adult movie. It's like he made them. He had 10 years of the perfect run of making them. And then the rest of them are kind of, it's all, yeah, it's, we never quite got back to that. And then you get people like Wes Anderson just pop into his life and he's in a ton of Wes Anderson movies. There's a whole bunch of like quirky, weird characters doing.
He seems to be like a totem now when he appears in something, not a totem, you know, like a good luck charm or something for these directors.
Yeah. And,
you know, his 2 seconds in The Irishman was this nice, like, hey, I'll do a funny scene with Bob and then be gone.
Yeah. And you don't have to de-age me. I'm not doing any of that, Marty. I'm not hanging around for months jumping around with these guys. I'm not doing any of that shit. But I'll just pop in.
Do you think, looking at it chronologically now, do you think that, like, the turn happened when he walked off of Eyes Wide Shut? Like, that's about when things...
Pretty much. Yeah.
I don't know how much of that story is true, but it's one of those stories that... It feels true that him just in the middle of a take going, you're out of your fucking mind, walking out the door.
I love that it's Gary Oldman.
That's how it happened in my head.
I love that it's Gary Oldman that tells the story, though. That it's like, this happened with Harvey. He's like, yeah, out of your fucking mind, just leaves. That's the Ghost catches a first class flight from London to New York. He's back in the city in the same day. Fuck this. I'm out. But like, that's so funny because like Eyes Wide Shut, you know, it's almost like two decades of amazing work between 79 and 99. That is the peak of his career. It is undeniable that there are so many incredible performances, obviously Europe and then the States. And they're typified by two things. One is like being miscast badly in Apocalypse Now and then Coppola going, this isn't working. Sorry, mate. And then he's like, okay. And then he leaves. And it doesn't dampen his ultimate impact on the culture. And then the last one is, you're out of your fucking mind. And then there's a whole different era after that. It's like two movies that he gets either sacked from or fires himself from. It's like, nah, this isn't me. And who do you get instead?
Both were the ends of those kind of movies for that particular era.
Yeah, exactly. So funny that, and then yeah, like then he pops up in like the Grand Budapest Hotel. He's just around for. He's now just the hope that you can have is like that. There's a new Wes Anderson movie, so you can see the Wes Anderson people get their check for that for that year or that every 2 years that they get to do the movie, the work for scale. I mean, he does pop up. Here's the best thing in the worst possible movie ever made, Red Dragon. Which is diabolical on all fronts. But the problem that everyone has in that movie is that Harvey Keitel pops up and he's the only person that is genuinely believable as like a character. Everyone else is like blonde.
Well, it's the most miscast movie ever made.
Yes. Yeah. It's ghastly.
It's all these wonderful actors and they're all playing exactly the wrong parts.
Yeah. You've got, I mean, look at this cast. Edward Norton, Mary Louise Parker, Philip Seymour Hoffman. Jesus Christ. God, they really turned out for like the worst movie of all time. Had any of these people seen Manhunter is my question. And you know what? It's been
fun, guys. Funny that I was just watching smoke again because Paul Auster died. So I'm so happy they're putting out this Blu-ray, especially with Blue in the Face, which you can't find anywhere, which I think is just the most fun movie. But Smoke is so funny because, you know, they have the, it ends with this like 11 minute monologue by Harvey.
Yes.
That they shot all this stuff reenacting. So when he tells the story, you would see in black and white that they could cut away to, you know, illustrating the story. And then when they, when Wayne Wang was putting the movie together, he's like, oh, I don't need any of that shit. We'll just keep this close up of Harvey telling the story.
God, Wayne Wang. Great filmmaker too. Couple of really good, some of his real good stuff on the Imprint label as well that is available. It's so good. But yeah, it's really funny because like that, at this time, it's this wrestle between these sort of weird Harvey roles, like pure funny or pure strange, like being a dad who was a preacher in From Dusk Till Dawn, which is a super fun performance. And then like, is he the devil in Little Nicky? He's the devil and he's Nicky's dad. Yeah. And Rodney Dangerfield is his grandfather. Like it's such a weird movie. Again, all New York guys, devils playing that. So he plays Judas and the devil. So that's a good one. And we don't talk enough about his devil performance. I mean, Pacino's getting more, more plaudits for Devil's Advocate and De Niro's getting, and De Niro's getting it for, oh my God, I've lost the name.
Angel Heart.
Angel Heart. Yeah. So we need an Angel Heart, Devil's Advocate, and Little Nicky marathon, I think, to show those three guys the devil. Or maybe you just,
I think I'm surprised though that like nobody else has ever followed the Blue in the Face template of, we finished a movie 2 days early, so let's film another one.
Yeah.
Call up your friends and we'll make up scenes.
Yeah. Incredible. What else about Harvey? What other Harvey films have we missed? What other patch is that, is if we're doing another film focus at some point with Imprint, if they're doing another film focus of Harvey, is it going into the '80s and picking up some of these like European films that maybe we haven't had a chance to see again? Like what are the next films that we're really missing that you want to get into a box set?
Oh, well, I don't know. I'm just thinking of like how often he plays Southerners.
Yes. Exclusively the Southern. It's not
like the Harvey for the Harvey of the South, like the most Brooklyn looking guy. And it's somehow in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore when he shows up in that hat listening to Dolly Parton. You're like, okay, sure.
Yeah, sure. Fine. He is great in The Two Jakes. The Two Jakes is not a great movie, but by comparison of today's movies, it's great. It's a fantastic movie.
Well, great might be saying. It's interesting.
It's weird and wonderful and interesting and grubby. And the sex
Nicholson
scene between...
has a weird sense of humor. I mean, we know that, obviously, but especially as a filmmaker.
Like, yeah.
There's strange jokes in that. That whole part when he's with Madeline Stone, that he starts snipping his fingers and like...
I was just thinking about that sex scene. It's one of the strangest sex scenes that's ever been in a movie because she's just like, she's wailing and like she's all over him and he's like, just shut up. She's like, shh, be quiet.
And he blows himself up at the beginning.
Yeah. It's, yeah. It's
a bizarre film.
It's a bizarre film. And Harvey's great in it. As
he seems like grounded. Everyone else is sort of off in crazy land in that film. he's like the one thing you can latch onto.
Yes. Oh man.
I don't know what I mean. God, when Bob Evans said he was going to play that part, I would like to see. I'd like to see that version.
The hostility in those scenes would have been at a crescendo. Because everyone hated him. Everyone hated Bob.
See the Evans tan with that kind of lighting on a giant screen, you know?
Really special. Well, look, man, thank you so much, firstly, for allowing me to like slide into your DMs for a really cool reason. To ask you to write about Bad Lieutenant, which you do so beautifully. So thank you. I can't wait for people to check it out.
Thank you for asking. That was an honor.
I can't, and for someone like Harvey, I think your words are so special. So I'm so looking forward to people getting their hands on this. But it's, I mean, in the next few months, Imprint is one of the, is now asking us, do we want to eat or do we want to buy physical media? And unfortunately, the problem is for some of us, it's like, actually, no, I don't need to eat this week. I think I need, I'll skip a few meals. I'm just going to buy these incredible things. So get your hands on what you can. Look for lots of specials, and but man, thank you so much. You're the best. And is there anything you want to plug? Have we anything that you want to shout out and plug that you're doing right now? Because I know you're always doing fun stuff with the Brattle. I know you're always writing NPR Boston.
Not really at the moment. I'm at a loss for things to plug.
Oh, next time you're back, you can plug anything you like that you've forgotten. Enjoy. This will come out a little bit after we've recorded it, because I'll try and put it a little bit closer to the Harvey set. Sets release, but
I was gonna say I have no idea what I'll be wanting to plug back.
Yeah, so a couple of months, so I'm gonna try and put it out about a month out, because I really want to build some hype, and I know that Alexi's gonna want to go through these flicks with me, so we will do a probably standard episode, but it'll be a nice bonus of us talking, folks listening. Guys, thank you for listening. Buddy, thank you so much for doing this. It's always great to see you, and hopefully some more cool box sets and opportunities I can get to get your writing in on some,
God bless you, man. I love doing it.
On some liner notes, baby. Physical media is back.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Prime Day es el 16 y 17 de julio. Con las ofertas épicas exclusivas para miembros Prime, recibe el reconocimiento que tanto mereces.
¡Wow! ¡Gracias! Ni siquiera preparé un discurso.
Quisiera agradecer a mi familia, que siempre necesita cosas. También a Sam, mi repartidor, por entregarme todas mis ofertas increíbles tan rápido. ¡Te adoro, Sam! ¡Mua!
Compra ofertas en electrónicos, hogar y más este Prime Day, del 16 al 17 de julio.